Welcome to a new edition of The Brand Called You. Today it is my privilege to invite and welcome Manit Jain to our show.
Thank you, sir.
Manit has a master's degree in education from Harvard, and he's the co-founder of Heritage Group of Schools. So Manit, tell me, what was the reason you decided to get into this business with such a different type of school?
So to begin with, it kind of just happened to me.
Okay.
So my father had a dream of setting up good schools, essentially with a simple goal of building good human beings. Of course, that was a very wide goal that did inspire me. But when I got into these schools full time, I actually figured, and I remember this very well, when I first walked into the classroom, it brought back horrid memories of my own schooling. It was a very visceral feeling.
Wow.
You know, one forgets their school experience or remembers mostly the outside the classroom experience.
Correct.
Once you get out of school. And then when I walked in, I think it had already been about 12 schools, 12 years since I left school.
Okay.
And it just brought back that same feeling.
Wow.
I could experience the same fear, the same judgment, and everything I had completely forgotten about my school experience. And that made me think that this is not right.
Correct.
I was pretty surprised because my dad had set up really good infrastructure and the school looked very different from where I went, even though I went to some of the best schools in the city. And I said, no, something needs to be done. Something is really
something
wrong.
Needs to be done differently.
And then I spent some time inside the classrooms, evaluated the textbooks. And as a part of the management, I wasn't supposed to do that.
Correct.
Because there was a principal who was supposed to perform the role of the academician. And the more I got into dialogues with the school principal and the staff, I realized that people had kind of given up on these systemic constraints. So every time I asked for some change, I was told, no, the system is like this. This is what parents want, and this is what teachers know how to deliver. And I said, but what about the kids?
Correct.
You and I were not happy doing this. How can our kids be happy doing this? And then I was told that a lot has changed. There isn't that level of fear. You know, we aren't slapping kids around, and
you know,
there aren't such harsh consequences. And
right.
Everything. I said, the actual transaction is still very inauthentic. It's very fake. It's just happening for the sake of covering syllabus.
Right.
Where is the relevance for the child? So that led to a series of dialogues with the school leaders and the educators. And I would pretty much sit with them every afternoon. And we would discuss about our own educational experience.
Okay.
And honestly, beyond that pain, I didn't have much inspiration to offer.
Okay.
But collectively, we came up with a couple of very powerful insights in terms of what traditional education does to us. And here is what they are. One, I realized that, you know, when I was growing up, I was in grade 8 or something, I often used to ask the question as to, why am I learning what I'm learning?
Correct.
And almost, there was a point about 13, 14, was totally disengaged with my education. And I never got an answer to that question.
Okay.
No teacher could answer that question. The standard response was, it's chapter number 4. It's in the book. It is going to be tested. You don't do well in this test. You won't do well in life.
Correct.
And that just did not create a sense of relevance.
Correct.
And we realized that when you don't get an answer to that question, the entire educational process becomes a hard duty.
Okay.
And it should really be perceived as a gift and not as a duty. And if at that age, you go through 14 years of your school education performing a hard duty, How do you come out of it?
Correct.
So we realized that most of us then had lives where everything had become a hard duty, making that college course, going through that college experience, then reaching your first job. There was very little sense of meaning or purpose because the why was not important. And at that point, we learned to conform to the global expectations of examination results. That's what meant success. And then the indicators of success changed to wealth or a bigger house or a bigger car. And again, everything that everybody else was chasing, we didn't really stop and ask ourselves what is important and why. So that taskfulness, the most you know, pronounced examples of that taskfulness are when we're counseling parents and we're having to tell them to spend quality time with their kids, because even that seems like a task to people. So that hard duty factor goes into everything.
I agree. So tell me, how are you doing things differently? I mean, give me some examples.
So, you know, the first couple of things, and actually there was another insight, which was around children not being able to be themselves.
Okay.
You know, because of the fear, because of the kind of judgment, the rankings, the comparison, and the entire social structure as such, both parenting and in schools, kids hardly had the opportunity to be themselves. And we wanted to change these two things.
Correct.
So that's where the difference began. And we focused then on three things: relationships, relevance, and rigor.
Okay.
In a traditional school, you would focus on a rigor, which also I would describe as mindless rigors, repetitive tasks, and a lot of drill and a lot of meaningless homework. But we said we'll start with relationships first.
Okay.
First, create a psychologically safe space for children where they can be themselves, where they can express themselves, where they have the space to make mistakes, to fail, to learn at their own pace, where they are not fitting to the curriculum. The curriculum is fitting to them. And the moment we did that and we built some sense of relevance through providing a more integrated curriculum, which means that it's not boxed in subjects.
Correct.
It happens as life happens. So at the earliest age, there are themes and integrated contexts that kids easily get into. And the learning is then incidental. As they go through that theme or project, the learning happens across disciplines. So kids don't really experience the burden. And it's common to find them going home and saying, hey mom, I learned this today and I don't remember having done that in my life.
That's true. That's
so, so that's the key difference, that so, we build a hook for them and we build very strong relationships and then the rigor follows.
Okay.
It's an outcome of these two things.
So help me understand, you know, child germs in the, you know, in the early years, but as they start getting into the high school, don't they have to get back into the same rut of clearing CBSE?
So that's a great question.
So how do you, you know, and you molded their minds to think very differently.
So it's interesting that you asked this, you know, of course we get this question a lot. In fact, initially we started the school in 2003. In 2005 we changed the entire pedagogy. In one shot we got rid of uniforms, we got rid of tests of any kind until grade 8. We got rid of the whole period block subject kind of system, and we got rid of all books. Because we wanted multiple books, we didn't want one textbook, we didn't want their learning to be limited by anything. And the parents completely freaked out. Obviously, they said our kids are not guinea pigs in this experiment of yours. And I repeatedly kept telling them, hey, all I can say is that nothing can be worse than what is. Any experiment will lead to an improvement. And of course, we were counting on some really cutting edge national research on education and some very basic and sound principles. But the big question, of course, was what will happen, because the system is not changing. And at that point, our assumption was that if you're fundamentally strong in your conceptual knowledge, the board examinations will not be a challenge. So I must admit that until grade 10 or grade 11, we're able to stay fairly aligned to our philosophy, although some bit of it needs to be diluted in grade 9 and 10, some bit of dilution in grade 11, but grade 12, there is complete dilution. Complete dilution of what we want to do. Because then we recognize that for this 1 year, we'll have to put them through the grind, actually tell them to not think out of the box, tell them to write traditional answers and follow the answer keys given by CBSE. But they're able to do exceedingly
amazing.
They're able to, so we consistently perform amongst the top 10 schools in CBSE.
That's quite amazing. So tell me, you know, in 2005, when you took the decision to, if I can use the word, stop conforming, that must have been a difficult time for you. To take such a big risk with such an amazing institution and so many children. What made you take this decision?
So I guess my conviction in the idea was very, very strong. But it started with what I did not want to. I had no idea about what else to do. I thought I was the first person in the world thinking like that. Because every educator I spoke to said, no, this is not happening. And then I went out and visited some of the alternate schools in India, the Krishnamurti schools, the Sri Aurobindo schools, and I saw some fantastic work. And as I spoke to a lot of these really evolved educators and spoke about change in a mainstream school, they said, see, it doesn't happen in the mainstream environment, because this is for very elitist parents who don't necessarily care about board examination results, whose definition of success is very different from the conventional parent. And you're not necessarily serving those parents. So it's going to be very difficult. And at the scale that you're talking about, it's very, very ambitious. Because we do it for 100 kids, 200 kids, 400 kids at most, in highly spiritual environments developed over, you know, 5 decades, 7 decades, 10 decades. So it won't be easy to replicate. And that's, I think, where I found the purpose of my life. I said, so these islands of excellence can provide inspiration, but we need a model in the mainstream where something different is happening. So I just took it upon
that. That's quite amazing. But my question, to you is that, you know, with such, now with so many years, 15 years since you made the change, you must be seeing your alumni doing well in life. Have you tracked how they are doing? So coming out of such a different education?
Yes, we have. And there are, for us, there are many success stories from one of the most celebrated DJs in the country at the age 23 to a lot of kids who've gone into social entrepreneurship, which makes us very, very proud, because somewhere the seed of purpose and meaning and real
and
education struck a chord with them. Many kids have gone into those areas. Many corporates have come back to us and said, there is a clear difference in your alumni, in the way that they're able to think, and the skills that they bring to the workplace to start with. It's very, very gratifying.
Amazing. So Mahesh, let me move to a little more generic subject of education in India.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as you said, you went to Rishi Valley and you went to Aurobindo mm-hmm. School, and you know, you said that's for a small community. But you've also been in education for 2 decades almost. How is education evolving in our country for the masses? Or is it still that same rote, and by the time you get to class 11, get a kunji and select 5 out of 7? That's how I grew up.
So it would be fair to say that I can count on my fingers between private and government schools schools where any real work is happening.
Okay.
For the most part, the transaction remains more or less
the same.
Yeah.
Wow.
India has a huge challenge.
Okay.
I don't blame the governments for this. We started very late.
Yeah.
Our primary education came on the anvil only in 1969, 22 years after independence was the first time we started really focusing on school education.
Correct.
And again, I can't blame Nehru for it. Mm. With all that he was dealing
yeah.
with, get the country started, he
yeah.
didn't really get a great deck of cards.
Correct. Correct.
Just managing basic literacy has been such a huge
yeah.
challenge. Getting quality education from people who themselves have had no quality education. So a teacher has pretty much gone through the same experience.
Correct.
The B.Ed. college experience is again pretty much
Correct.
The same.
Correct.
We have about 17,000 B.Ed. colleges, out of which 16,000 don't require classes. We know people just go write an exam with
yeah.
the same kunji that you described.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then how are they going to
Correct.
Prepare the nation?
Correct.
So the challenges remain pretty much the same.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody wants to make reforms. CBSE is trying to make some really progressive reforms.
And yet illiteracy has increased from 50% in the 50s to 82%.
It has, but it means very little.
Or is it just a number?
It's just, it has.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people can read
mm-hmm.
and write.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's
but it's not
it.
Where you would
yeah.
want to see
yeah, but,
education.
But can they comprehend? Can
I
they
agree.
Make meaning? Can they apply that knowledge?
Mm-hmm.
Can they? Are they really, truly educated?
Mm-hmm.
Even if I look at myself, I mean, I got my education at my workplace, not necessarily in my school.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I had to read up my history again.
Correct.
I had to read up
Correct.
My sciences again.
Yeah.
Everything. It was like,
relearning
the school
everything.
Education never happened.
Amazing. So one more question for you. You know, in most of our schools, and you know, Heritage is a very, very different school. But for the thousands of people who will listen to you and me talking, there is this incredible pressure cooker environment. And if you're not the best, you'll go to B. And if you're slightly less, you'll go to C. And, you know, and there'll be 15, 18, 19 sections of every class. What does it do to the children? I mean, you know, you have experiencing a very different environment because you're doing things differently. Yet
yeah.
28 million children are being added to our country every year.
Right.
What do we do to make changes for such a large cohort of children being added?
Again, no easy answers.
I'm sure.
No easy answers
yeah.
to something like that. And I think one ray of hope is that 20 years ago, nobody was even talking about it.
Correct.
Now, when I go to conferences, the debate is shifting. There is an intention to make change. People recognize that it's going to be a social and an economic imperative now. If we don't change education, we're going to really fail our children.
Correct.
But how do you do it? There are 5 or 6 things that I can think of. One is invest in leadership development for schools.
Okay.
So we still do not have a single university that offers a course for developing school leaders.
Okay.
So the best performing physics teacher or English teacher or PE teacher becomes the principal
mm-hmm.
of the school.
Mm-hmm.
not necessarily for the leadership or administrative managerial skills the person has, but because the person was a good teacher.
Correct.
In most cases, you lose a good teacher and you don't have a good principal.
Yeah.
So that's one very big thing that needs to be focused on, school leadership development at all levels.
Correct.
At district level. So who's going into, who's becoming the district education officer or the superintendent, regional director. Mm. There are several posts. You need to empower all of those posts. For example, in the US, the public education system is fairly well evolved.
Yep.
And while we talk a lot about the Finnish system, the scale at which change is happening in the US is remarkable.
Okay.
And it's not easy to do it with these standards and frameworks that they have developed, but they invest heavily in leadership development. So Harvard and many universities run these 3-year leadership development programs where they pay people $40,000 or $50,000 to do that course. They find the creme de la creme of the country and put them in education. And then they lead districts, they become school principals, and you have a whole pipeline that can then
Quite
work
incredible.
With ordinary resources.
Quite
the other
incredible.
Thing I would say is teacher development. We need very serious investment in continuous professional development also of teachers and in the BEd program itself.
Mm-hmm.
Make good teachers and we'll have good education.
So my next question to you is, you spoke a little bit when you were talking about heritage, that we encourage our children, the children, to do various things, and if they fail, you don't look down upon it.
Right.
My next question to you is on failure, and I have often asked this to many people, that in our country particularly, and I think in Asia in general, we don't teach children that it's okay to fail,
right.
Which leads to a lot of stress. Every parent says first aana hai, class mein sabse aage raho, har ek queue mein sabse aage, and that manifests itself in our behavior patterns. Traffic lights and aircraft and wherever else. And yet, I heard you say, talk of failure, even though very, very fleetingly. What can we do to teach children that it's okay to fail?
So, we believe in something called the growth mindset.
Correct.
I don't know if you're familiar with this experiment, this research, this professor at Stanford called Carol Dweck Rands, this whole body of work where she got two sets of kids, gave them a task, two different tasks, same set of kids, two different tasks, one easy, here you're likely to succeed, one hard, you don't know if you're going to succeed.
Correct.
And they tracked these kids then over a long period of time, those who took the harder task really succeeded in life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you're right. We encourage people to work in their frontier of competence.
Right.
That I want to do something where I look good,
mm-hmm.
and if I go beyond my frontier of competence and I fail, I wouldn't look good.
Mm-hmm.
But if I don't go beyond my frontier of competence, how will that frontier expand?
Mm-hmm.
How will I grow? So in our system, what we've done is we've completely changed the metric.
Mm-hmm.
Because there is no testing, there is no competition.
Correct.
Kids are not driven by coming first or second or third. Their assessments are very individualized. There's a lot of reflection in the classroom. The only times, there will be a situation where a child is feeling not included is, say, when they do a project together and they're doing a product at the end of it, and one child has drawn, 10 children have drawn something, and now one drawing needs to be picked for the final product.
Okay.
And even then we'll get into reflections with kids where they'll say, okay, what should be picked up?
Wonderful.
And then we'll ask them, okay, and I've asked these questions to kids myself. So, are you feeling bad that your drawing didn't get picked up?
Mm.
And the child says, I do feel bad, but I also recognize that I need to work harder.
Okay.
I can do better. This wasn't my best work. And I also do recognize that my friend's work was great, and that's the work that deserves to be
there. That's fantastic. So, for a child to be able to acknowledge that.
And I'm talking about a fourth grade child.
Yeah.
Very young children get to see this and understand that in the end, if you're willing to make an effort, you can do pretty much anything.
Fantastic. You know, over the years, have you had any mentors?
Mm-hmm.
And if yes, what have you learned from them?
Okay, so two mentors. Mm-hmm. One, I must mention my father, whom I just lost.
Oh, sorry to hear that.
About 4 months ago. And the one thing that I saw in him, he was a self-made man totally, was his level of perseverance, his level of grit, determination, just never giving up under any circumstances. He, in the number of times he moved, what he did, he was in a government job to begin with, and then he decided to become an entrepreneur. He'd been in the government job for about 7 or 8 years. And this thing I remember very, very vividly. One fine day, he said he's going to start a business. And mom and dad were talking, and we overheard. Mom said, "You've got to leave. Why don't you go on a sabbatical for 6 or 8 months, try this out, and go back to your job if this doesn't work out?" And he said, "Neeru, no, that's not happening. I'm quitting, because if I do that, I'll have a plan B. I'll never make that successful."
Okay.
So that's how he lived his life.
Fantastic.
And I think what I learned was that give whatever you do,
everything
that you have, and if you constantly keep looking at a safety net,
then
you'll probably fall
there. Absolutely right.
And my other mentors, Pammi, he still works with us, Parminder. He's somebody who really showed me that I was more than who I thought I was. Who really showed me that I was possible, and he did that with at least 50 people in our school community, and that's a DNA we've carried in our school, to do that for every teacher and for every child. You're boundless.
Yeah, fantastic. So Manit, I want to just thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you, and I wish Heritage School, you, and everybody who's a stakeholder in your venture all the very best.
Thank you so much, Ashton. Absolute pleasure talking.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Brand Called You podcast. Be sure to visit tbcy.in to join the conversation, access show notes, and discover fantastic bonus content. You can follow us on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Simply search for The Brand Called You. Thank you, and see you next week.